You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Over the last 2 and a bit years, I've done several episodes on Bigfoot and the Sasquatch, but probably neglected one of my favourite cryptids, the Yowie. Thankfully, this week, I rectify that fact, as I welcome back one of my very first guests, Yowie Dan, to return to Mysteries and Monsters. Since we last spoke, Dan has appeared in a fantastic Yowie documentary, Track, Searching for Australia's Bigfoot, by filmmaker Attila Cundy. I can't recommend Track highly enough. It's probably the best documentary out there covering the Yowie phenomenon, and if you haven't seen it, you can check it out on Amazon Prime, YouTube, and Tubi. Dan tells us all about the filming, some of the points and aspects of the Yowie that the film covers, and some incidents they definitely weren't expecting and seem very unrelated to the Yowie. As always, before we get there, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up for Patreon. Go to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters, or you can click on the link in this week's show notes as always. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, early access, bonus content, and I've just dropped a Q&A for all my Patreons. You can also find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also find the mysteriesandmonsters.com website, where you can find news and also click on the links to get yourself some Mysteries and Monsters merchandise. Thank you as always to my brother Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork for this week's episode. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So, the Blue Mountains await us as we go on the hunt with Dan for the Yowie.
On this week's show, we make a long overdue return to Australia to discuss all things Yowie. I'm delighted to welcome back a good friend to the show, Yowie Dan, as we dive back into Australia's cryptid conundrum. Dan, welcome. How are we?
Oh, I'm going good, Paul. What about yourself?
Yes, I'm all right. We're both post-COVID, mate, so we're both survivors. We're doing all right, aren't we?
Yeah, I can hear Eye of the Tiger, you know, like Rocky. I can jump up on the stairs and go, yeah, I've survived one bout of COVID. So
yeah. Take it steady though, mate. My advice for you: just take it steady. Don't be running up too many stairs just yet.
No, I'm just gonna sit back on the lounge for the next week and watch Australian Open tennis. So that's my week. Yeah.
Yeah, the power of a sporting recovery, mate. It's all good.
Yeah, somebody else can run around all I like.
Oh, so Dan, I mean, obviously the last time we spoke, as we were joking before we started, was back in 2019, and you were planning on working with a director down there called Attila in regards to this documentary called Track, which came out sort of 2020. And I watched it when it first came out, and I recently rewatched it because I was really impressed with it at the time. So for anybody that's not aware of your history and your love of investigating the Yowie, what happened to get you to a point where Attila wanted you to be in his film? How did you get into the investigation and search for the Yowie, my friend?
Oh, well, just briefly, because I've told this story so many times, I used to train greyhounds and just for fun, you know, kind of thing. Anyway, there's a place called Appin, A-P-P-I-N. It's about 70 kilometres south of Sydney. And so we go down there just to trial some greyhounds. It's a straight track. It's good for dogs that, you know, I've had injuries so they don't hurt shoulders and that. So anyway, I'm down there and it's 400 meters long. So I'm down the bottom and all the other people are up halfway up and I'm just waiting my turn. And anyway, it's I think it was a July morning on a Tuesday, about 7:30 in the morning. It's all foggy and cold and I'm kind of just standing there shaking with the dog waiting for a trial to happen. And Next thing, the dog turns around and my greyhound never barked at all. This is the first time she barked and all the hair stood up on her back, and she's just barking like scared, and she's backing up into me, but she's standing in between what it was, whatever it was in the bush to, and me. And I'm like, what's wrong, Sally? What's wrong? And giving her a pat, and she keeps looking at me, looking back, and she's just going off. And if it was like a small animal, like a rabbit or something, mate, she'd be want to go in there and chase it. That's their nature. But within about 10 seconds of her barking, this massive big roar, rawr, like something with a massive chest, just screamed out. And then it started shaking this big tall gum tree, which was about 20 meters tall, and you could hear the cracks of the big of the roots in the ground, because they've got a big root system. And it just used crack, 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 and there was no trails or anything there where a tractor would go. And if it was a tractor, I would hear the tractor knocking it over. But back then, there was nothing. Now there's, I think, a paintball gun area, which is there's a bit of a thickness of the bush, and then it's been opened up for a paintball facility. Anyway, but at the time, yeah, this thing's shaking the trees around, bang, crash, boom, and then it just ran off, and it was just going through the bush, just pushing little branches and trees over, and it had, like, its footsteps were like massive thuds, like, you know, big sledgehammers just hitting hard ground. And then I'm just like, what the hell is that? And it freaked me out. And so me and the dog run up to the other people 200 meters away and go, did you hear that? Did you hear that? And they're like, what? And they go, you look like you've seen a ghost, and your dog looks like it's been electrified. It's all got its hair standing up. And we go, something's down there in the bush. And then we'll look back, and there's this big tree just leaning up against other trees. It would have fell over if it didn't lean up against another couple of trees. So basically I went back and looked up on the internet straight away, and looking up Yowie, I just thought, this thing might not be a myth after all. It might be actually real. So that was in 2005, and that's what got me into Yowies in the first place.
How long is it from that point on then, Dan, that you decided to start going out and having a look for it? Because obviously over the years you've collected some equipment to help you out there. And obviously, I mean, you're very fortunate where you live, because I think, as we've said previously, a lot of people seem to just have a real strange idea of what Australia is in regards to this. And I'm often amazed how many people just don't understand this rainforest area in the southeast, because it's absolutely stunning. I had a listener a few months ago who goes out hiking in the Blue Mountains, and he sent me loads of pictures, Dan, and it's just unbelievable. The depth and the stretch of these areas, it's absolutely jaw-dropping just how forested and hilly these areas are. So was that the kind of place where you thought, when you started getting into the Yowie, this is where I want to go? Or did you start going out from around where you'd had your encounter in Appin?
No, I didn't do anything in Appin at that stage. When I looked up and started looking into the places where the Yowie had been seen or been encounters or weird things happening, it was in the Blue Mountains. And Blue Mountains is about 75 k's west of Sydney. So you just get on the M4 motorway and just keep heading west, and as soon as, you know, within half an hour of Sydney, you'll just see the mountains. And they give a blue tinge because it's the when it gets hot, the eucalyptus trees, they give off, the oil comes out of their leaves and then evaporates, and it gives it that blue kind of tinge. That's why they're called the Blue Mountains. But it's got the most sightings and that of anywhere in the country, and they've been consistent from pretty much day one. But you got to look at this, the Blue Mountains, it took the European settlers like about 25 or 6 times to make it over to the other side. And when they did do that, there was 3 guys, and they had a couple of indigenous blokes helping them out, and it took them 21 days to get across to the other side, where Lithgow and other places are that are there now. And but it took them like 6 days to get back. And the reason why they got over so easier is they used the top of the ridges, where the other times they were trying to follow the creeks, and the creeks just zigzag and go everywhere. And I try to follow the creeks sometimes, and it's just impossible to try and get through places from A to B following the creek, unless you're swimming in the creek, because there's fallen trees and there's vines and there's everything else, fallen rocks and everything, and you just can't get from A to B. It's really hard. So you got to stick to the trails until, you know, you want to go to a certain area to go and camp, and you can bush bash it a bit. But, it's like you said, you go to probably the well-known place, which is Katoomba, where the Three Sisters are. Mm-hmm. And if you look southwards, you got the Mount Solitary, and in the middle there is called the Jameson Valley. And if you go to Mount Solitary or to the right of the Three Sisters, it's called Naranek, and it's a big, long plateau that goes right out. It takes you about 2.5 hours to hike to the end. And as far as you can see, it's just mountains and mountains, like small hills. It's just bushland is going as far as you can see. So I think the Blue Mountains would nearly cover a small country. That's how big it is. That's just one place in Australia. Like, people don't realize there's a lot of bushland in Australia where it didn't get burnt with the bushfires in 2019, 2020, but a lot did. But it grows back pretty quick. You know, it'd take a couple of years and you wouldn't even know there's a bushfire there. But, yeah, I started going to the Blue Mountains to do my research, and I started on easy trails because there's some trails there that are, put it bluntly, bloody hard, where you know you come out and you're hurting, mate, you're hurting, and that's just with a small backpack, not going in with gear or tents or anything like that like we do now.
Yeah. So throughout that period then, Dan, obviously you were going out and doing stuff. How did you connect with Attila? Because when he's doing the introduction to Track, which is an absolutely fantastic documentary, and I recommend that if anybody hasn't seen it, they really need to get it. I know you can watch it on YouTube, and it's available on Amazon Prime in the US and Canada.
You can watch it on you can watch it on Tubi TV. So if you download the app Tubi TV, you can watch Track for free. I just got the Tubi TV app on my phone, and I've got it on my TV, and you just write in Track and it comes up, and there's a few ads in it which say that's how they make their money, and you can watch it for free on Tubi TV.
Yeah. So how did you get together with Attila? Because obviously Attila's reasoning for creating this documentary was that he'd had an experience around the same time you had yours, this sort of mid period of the noughties at the turn of the century. And Attila, when he's telling it, he had a very similar kind of reaction to you. And I would imagine most people that end up encountering a Yowie, even if they just hear it, Dan, it clearly does shake you, because anybody with any knowledge of Australian wildlife will know that after the kangaroo, there is nothing that's a large marsupial down there. This is the thing about often when people talk about Bigfoot and Sasquatch and the Yeti, the go-to explanation usually there, Dan, in Canada and the US and Asia and places, is, oh, well, people have seen a bear, it's a bear. I mean, that's the thing that's always fascinated me about the Yowie, is the fact that the fauna of Australia does not have anything else after the kangaroo that could even be slightly mistaken. And with the greatest respect, kangaroos don't look anything like bipedal primates or monkeys or whatever. So I've always taken these stories probably with a bit more credence than some encounters that I've heard from North America, primarily, Dan, because for me, there's nothing else it could be. It has to be what people are claiming they're encountering.
But there is that small margin of people that don't go out a lot in the bush. And until you've been near a big male kangaroo, you don't realize how big they are and how big their chest and that is. Like they're big bastards, mate. And I'll tell you what, if they get hold of you, you're in trouble, because they can rip you up. They can rip you up. Like, actually, years ago, just north of Sydney, there's Gosford. You probably travel an hour by car. It was called Old Sydney Town. It was like, we used to go there for school, and it was like anyone can go there. And it was like people dressed up like, you know, back in the days when just after Sydney was just, you know, when Captain Cook first came, and it made it look like it was the first 20 years of Sydney, and there was people getting like, it was like soldiers, and there was criminals running around, and there was little places where you could buy stuff and that. And it was really good. You learned a lot about Sydney back in the day. But like, we went there, and it was me and my mates, and we're like in year 10 at school. We thought we'd, you know, really good, and we're walking around, and next minute we just find another kid that's probably about 10 years old, that was with another school there at the time, and it was a kangaroo. It wasn't a big male, but it was 5'6" or 5'7" high. Mm. But it had this poor kid, grabbed him by the back of the head, and it was just kicking him in the stomach and kicking him in the gut, like one after the other, like bang, 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 bang. And this kid just couldn't breathe. And he was purple and blue when we ripped him off this kangaroo. One of my mates is punching on with the kangaroo like a boxing match. Yes. Well, we're trying to bring this kid alive. Like, we had to give him mouth to mouth and stuff to get him alive. We saved this kid's life. So that's how dangerous they are. This roo wasn't big, but if he grabs a little kid, I'll kill him. Yeah. But roos are really big if you're close to them. And if you want to get a bit of a, like, look at it, and you're in the bush, and you see a bit of it, people can be mistaken for thinking, oh, that's a yowie, because what's a kangaroo doing in the middle of the bush? Mm. The odd occasions, they like the grass more. They like the open plains, and they cruise around. But the odd times you'll see big grey males in the middle of Blue Mountains where it's not really their area. And that's what I found that will be sometimes. You've probably got a small percentage, maybe 10, 15% of all the sightings in the Blue Mountains are attributed to a big roo going from one place in the Blue Mountains to another. Mm. So it can happen. But if, like, for myself, we've been out there that many times and you hear the foot hit and you'll hear it bounce and you'll go, yeah, you just know the gap of where the real, like, land on the ground until it lands again, and then you'll hear it, and then you'll go, oh, no, it's a roo. You just know, just by experience. But some people don't know that. But when I've been out in the Blue Mountains and you hear things walking along the ridgeline, and you can hear it's like step, 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 not bounce, bounce, it's different. And you just go, we're 2.5 hours in the bush. What's walking around in the bush like 20 meters from us stalking us, Like, and you go, all right, they're around. So they do sometimes let you know they're there, but you just can't see them. They're buggers, mate. But I've got a thermal monocular now, so it's a different story. If they come within 20 meters or 100 meters off me, I can pick them out with my thermal in the bush. If it's, the thermal can't see through the bush. It can only see where it's open, but I've got a better chance now of seeing them. So, but yeah, there's like he said, there's nothing else out there that's like a roo. Everything else is small, like a wombat or opossums and little wallabies. So, there's nothing that you could mistake it with other than a roo, which is what I reckon contributes a small amount of the sightings.
Yeah. And the other thing as well is obviously that roos don't tend to behave like people report as well, Dan, because, as you refer to it, I mean, I've mentioned this before, the famous Roger the kangaroo. If anybody is unaware of just what kangaroos can do and how strong they are, just look for footage of Roger the kangaroo squashing buckets. And I think that'll put you in the mindset of making sure that you never keep them. And I know there's a recent piece of footage of some women playing golf over Christmas, and suddenly an audience of kangaroos turn up, and there's a couple of big ones in that gang that's come to watch them tee off, which is quite funny, actually, watching them just sort of hanging about. So when Attila decided to approach you in regards to doing the film, Dan, what was the general concept of it? Was it that Attila had already got an idea of who he wanted to speak with, or was it a case of he just said, right, I'm looking for people who want to do a documentary going out into the Blue Mountains. Are you interested, or do you know anybody that could help? So how did that sort of all come about? How did you and Attila get to work together, Dan?
Well, Attila and myself, our lives had crossed paths way back when he was running his UFO group in Campbelltown, which is just south of Sydney. And so I knew of Attila, and way back in the early, this is like 2000, 2001, 2002. And because I was training the dogs and I had twin boys, I couldn't go to the, like, it was like every fortnight they had a meeting, and it used to run late and I used to work early. So I had to give something up. So unfortunately I had to give that up. So I knew of Attila before, and he was, showing some little videos and stuff he'd make, you know, and little kind of small documentaries, which was just for the group. And he had some, you know, he had a school level back then when he was only really just getting into it. So when I got an email one day just happened to pop up on my Australian Yowie Gmail account, and it just said, "Hi, this my name's Attila Coldy, and I want to make a documentary and blah blah blah." And I've just he basically just see he's not a researcher. People think he's a researcher because he's out there, and but he's more a filmmaker and a producer. So he's not he doesn't class himself as a researcher at all. So he's out there to film what we do, but he just happens to be there, so people think he's a researcher. So he sent me an email and he said, I want to contact a few people and you're one, because I've seen like the stuff that you've been doing, and I know you live in Sydney, it's easy to contact you, and would you want to meet up? And I'm like, so I sent him an email, I said, yeah, you know, like I used to go to your UFO meetings, you don't remember me, but he's like, oh geez. Met up and I brought a laptop and showed him some of the stuff that he hasn't seen and he hasn't heard, and he's like, oh wow. He goes, would you want to be in it? I'm like, oh yeah, cool. You know, I know you are not there to make people look stupid, because sometimes people get into these, you know, go and get asked to do films, and then in the end, like, it just makes them look dumb when they're not really that. They're not stupid. They're just going out trying to find what they've encountered in the bush. And if they believe it's a Yowie and people don't believe it, well, then, you know, sometimes it makes them look stupid. But Attila, I know he's there. He said, no, I'm here to try and, you know, find out what this thing is, because I've had my own encounters, you know, like. He said to me then that they were out at a place called McMahon's Lookout around that area, which is, yeah, it's pretty much you can look back and see on an angle to your right, you can see the Jameson Valley and the Three Sisters in the distance. And he said they were there one time, and a big rock the size of a basketball got thrown up from down the ridge about 10 meters and got thrown at him. Like, who can throw a big rock about a basketball size that probably weighs 20, 30 kilos and throw it 10 meters up in the air and to try and – yeah, yeah. So he's like, what did that? Like, they were freaked out. So they took off. That was in – it was at the nighttime. And he had a couple other things that happened to him at the nighttime where he saw a big black kind of thing standing there, like a silhouette, and they just go into the bush. And he was just like, we're getting out of here. So – he had his own encounters that, you know, made him shit his pants. So he basically, we talked and we kind of worked. I asked him like where he wanted to go with the documentary, and it sounded, you know, really professional. And I'm like, yeah, let's do it. So it was basically, we met up once, and then, he said, we just want to do a few trailers. So we did a few trailers where it shows me walking down a trail and just to get people interested and tell them that this is what's going to happen. And yeah, we just started going out, and, he's pretty much didn't know many areas. And I said, look, I've got a few areas where I know they're active consistently. So let's go out. And one of them was Marramarra National Park. And that's where during that doco, we had, like, we found a few little kind of dens, and then we found these trees that had been broken, and what, like, branches, and actually part of the trunk had been like a seesaw, teeter-totter, or whatever you want to call them. And it was just like hanging on, it was just like balancing on top of the tree. And then we found another massive one like that, and then we found a few footprints, and then in the background there's like eye shine, there's something looking at us. And there wasn't a – people said it looks like an owl, but there's nothing there for an owl to perch on. Owls like to perch. They don't like to grip onto the side of trees. They like to perch on trees and be nice and comfortable. And then later on when we were kind of making our way out, and we kind of stopped on the trail, and we said, we'll just turn lights off and we'll just sit there and chat and see if something gets attracted to us. And then things started shaking really weird, and next minute we hear like a rock getting thrown through the trees, and it hit one of these – like, this tree was dead, but it was not going to fall over, and it hit this tree, and it fell over across the trail, and then we've turned the lights on, and we're like, what the hell's going on? So, we had a few weird things happen while we've been out, and, so we basically just had a bit of a chat, and it seemed like he was legit, and everything he was doing was going to not, you know, make me or anyone else look like a fool. And that we went from there, and it's just gone from strength to strength, and we've become really good mates. And, you know, and we've been going out a bit lately. Haven't had much success, but it's because of the fires. Those fires, 2019, 2020, really ravaged the Blue Mountains and up and down the coast. And till this day, you can still see, like, if you go along Bell's Liner Road or even to some of the lookouts in the Blue Mountains around the Blackheath, Grace Valley area, there's just, you can see rock formations that you would never see before because the trees have just been burnt to tree stumps, you know? So, yeah, that's basically how it happened.
Yeah. I mean, I was very impressed as well because obviously there's not just you in this documentary, Dan. There's several researchers that are involved. Obviously, there's a couple of very well-known cryptozoologists. Gary Opitz obviously lends his expertise, and it's always nice to hear from Gary. Gary's somebody I've had the pleasure of speaking with, and he's an absolute star. And with his level of experience being a ranger and how long he's worked in the field, you've got to take on board what Gary's saying. And obviously, but I was really interested because obviously there's another gentleman called Neil Frost.
Yep.
And I never really considered this, and I think often it's what gets overlooked because obviously Track is called the Search for Australia's Bigfoot, and yet Neil is probably one of the first people that I've heard who's essentially saying, well, I don't think it is anything like Bigfoot. The only similar thing is obviously it's a bipedal with hands, but he was really sort of trying to make the case for the fact that he believes it's a marsupial creature that's evolved on its own, and it shouldn't really be kind of linked with Bigfoot because, as far as he's concerned, they're two separate creatures.
Yeah, well, that's what Gary said as well, that like a marsupial ape or something like that.
Mm.
I'm not quite sure about any of that, but look, everyone's got their own ideas about what it could be. And look, no one's wrong, until we actually find the creature and someone can study it, and then we can go, look, this is exactly what it is. But I've only had a glimpse of a big one once up at the Wadigans, which is just, you're probably looking 2 hours north of Sydney. Went up there with a mate, and actually one growled at me and ran up the ridge, and I'm got a little walkie-talkie thing, and I'm like, hey, Adam, it's coming up. He's like, what? I said, it's running up towards you. He goes, oh, I can hear it. And then I could hear him chase it. And then, he's running through the bush, but he said it was like Predator. Like, the leaves are all moving everywhere, but I couldn't see it. Like,
yeah.
I'm like, what? And anyway, so I kind of went back up the ridge, and then it kind of backtracked. It did like a D shape. So Adam's running along, and it's going around in like a half semicircle, and it come back around to where I was kind of walking back up the ridge. And then I kind of seen it to my right about probably 100 meters away, and it was raw black. Its head was pretty much no neck, and it was solid. It wasn't really tall, but it was bloody solid. And like when you see those Olympic walkers in the marathon and all that, in the Olympics, and you don't think they're walking fast until you see people on push bikes next to them or someone running, and you think, gee, they're going quick. So this creature was doing that. It was just walking, and its arms were swinging out like the Patterson-Gimlin Bigfoot, and it just went like that quick into the bush. And I'm like, if that's walking and it's going that quick, what chance have we got of running after it? Like, there's no hope. So we end up chasing it down into the bush, but we couldn't see it. We could hear it going through the bush and getting away from us. But, I've seen one. And to me, it looked like a big bloody ape, but I didn't see its face, and it was 100 meters away, and it was like, it went past, there was big trees there, so in the gaps in between every tree, I could see it for like every second stride.
Yeah.
And it was gone. But I've seen a small one, a Jundjidi, which is only about a 3.5 foot creature, and it was looking at me, and it shows you the picture of that in Track. Exactly. That's pretty much exactly what I saw.
Mm.
And I never told anyone what color its face was. It had like a bluey gray face. And then someone that was talking to me years ago, he said, I've seen him. And I just said to him, look, what color is its face? And he said, oh, it's blue gray. And I went, when I heard that, I went, yeah, he has seen him because I've seen one, and that's what his face was looked like.
Mm.
So, yeah, but Attila, he's really good at making the documentaries where he's got his own little sound studio and he's got some really good gear. And when we do things and it doesn't seem like quite right, he says, can we please do it again? Because sometimes we're on our hike, we're going into the area to go film, and he wants to film us on their way in, like a lead into where we're going. And if we don't do it properly, can you walk back up again the hill and do it again? I'm like, come on, man, I've got a 40-kilo backpack, and I've done that part of the hill four times already. You know, so it's not easy. You know, it's not like we do it once, you know, but, you know, like the – I'll tell you one thing. You know the part when I'm with Tony Jinks and we're looking at the video in track where I got the Bigfoot in, or the Yowie in the back of the, when I was trying to film a broken branch?
Yes.
Well, that was done in one take because unfortunately Tony's mother was dying at the time. She was very, very sick. So he had to go to Lithgow. And no one knows this. That was so much pressure that day because it's about a kilometre hike into along this trail in Glenbrook, and every, you know, it's like kids in the back of the car. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Like, I was getting asked a lot, like, how long is it? Cause he wanted to film it and quickly get in the car and go to Lithgow. Cause his mum, you know, so he said to Attila, we'll quickly do this in the morning. I've got to go to my mum. So the pressure was building, and I didn't know this until Attila told me on the way, like, his mum's really sick, and, you know, I'm like, oh, my God, why don't we just do it tomorrow, you know, kind of. He goes, nah, he's only got time today, and he said he'll do it. He's happy to do it. I'm like, all right. So we got down there. We went down to the thing, and he just hit record, and we just went bang and did it, and it ended up being really good.
Mm.
And it turned up, and that was just one take. Everything you see was just one take. Nothing was done twice, and pretty much once we finished it, bang, he was gone. He just went on the trail and ran back down the trail where we kind of like packed up some of the gear and walked back. And I was just like, Attila, that was the most stressful thing I've ever done in my life when, you know, because my father died of cancer, you know, about 10 years ago. And I know what it's like. So I just did it as quick as I can. He goes, you guys are brilliant. He goes, just the chemistry was so good between you guys. He asked the right questions. You answered the right way. It just worked. I don't need to do it again because I thought it just come out shit.
Yeah.
But he just went, when I watched it, I went, shit, I didn't know it was that good. So, yeah. So some of the times we've been out, it's been stressful to get things done, you know. So we just happened to really gel together that day, me and Tony, and it worked out well, you know. So.
Yeah, I was very impressed with Tony. Tony's a very intelligent man. Obviously, he lectures at the University of Western Australia, and I know he specializes in neuroscience and does a lot of work in regards to the field of paranormality. Normally, Dan, he's very interested in a wide variety of topics, and he's a deeply thoughtful man. So it was very interesting when you were doing that section, because obviously when you caught that picture of something hanging off or next to that outcrop. Tony's very sort of forensic in regards to, he went to where the picture was, he looked at it, he could see what was what. So he was very thoughtful in regards to how he was looking at, not trying to say you were wrong, but I think he was just trying to get it right in his own mind, Dan, what on earth it could possibly be. Because obviously when you went back to that place, whatever the picture you've got shows clearly isn't there. So it was something, and like Tony, when he's saying, well, it can't, I mean, this is the thing you often hear. Well, he's like, well, it's either a really tall man, and I think you said, yeah, it's a very tall man, or somebody on stilts. And you're like, well, are you really going to be wandering around the bush in stilts hoping somebody sees you?
Yeah, look, it's the camera I had, it was like an old Panasonic little handheld video camera, and it was digital tape. This is when you had a little tape, like a little VHS tape, and it was digital tape, and you put it in, and that's how you filmed it. And look, I don't know anything about cameras, even to this day. But look, when my camera starts up, I'm lucky with Attila. I go, Attila, fix my camera, reset it. He sits there and hits all the buttons on the screen. Yeah, here you go, it's good again. But I just opened it up, and it was its basic setting. So when I filmed it, you got to realize that I wasn't trying to film it. I was trying to just film me. Like, I went there, I just had an Achilles ankle operation where I got a lot of calcification built up in between. I was on the back of the heel and inside the tendon. So they had to take the tendon off, hour and a half operation to chip this bone away, re-stitch the tendon on. I was in hospital for days. I was on crutches for like 5-6 months. People that have any kind of tendon problems and have operations, I know what I'm talking about. Anyway, I was a bit jealous of other people going out, so I just wanted to go along an easy trail.
Yeah.
And this was the easiest trail I could walk along. So that's why I went to this area in the first place. Even though I'd been putting sound recorders out, and I've been getting some good little results, you know, not major, but things that said to me that something might may be there. Anyway, so that's why I went there in the first place, and it was raining and I'm limping, and I was like doing physio for 3 months, and I told the physio I went there, and he told me off because he said I could have ripped it off the bone.
Yeah,
I'm like, oh well, I would have crawled back home or hopped on one leg. Anyway, so I'm down there just walking around, and I walk past this tree break because I was in pain and trying to take my time to get down. Anyway, I've got down. I finally went, oh, what's this tree break? I want to try and see if I can snap it, if it's easy, to show people how hard it is. So as I've put the camera down an angle on this rock, that's why it's pointed back up that way, and it's got whatever was there. And I didn't see it, didn't hear it, didn't smell it, or nothing like that. Anyway, I've gone home. I've watched the video 5 times until I've seen it. So it wasn't something that stuck out straight away. So what I do, I take my videos home and I watch one corner of the video, a quarter up the whole screen. And so I'm concentrating on this corner for an hour, just see if I can see something. Don't see nothing, concentrate on the next corner. So I've gone there and watched it, couldn't see nothing. And then as I'm just watching it again, I just went, hey, well, there's something in the background there. So I cut that part out. And I went to a fellow researcher, Dave Reed, and he lives down in Canberra, which is about 3.5 hours south of Sydney. And I said, Dave, look at this. And back then, I never put anything on YouTube. I just put it on YouTube because it was like Facebook and stuff were in their infancy, so it was hard to send things. So I just put it on. I just put it on YouTube for a bit till he saw it, and then I just took it off, deleted it.
Yeah.
I wanted to keep all my back then. I wanted to keep all my stuff to myself, kind of thing. But now I'm happy to. Everything is just on there because mainly there was a few dodgy researchers out there. I wanted to show people around the world that there was people out there doing actually proper research and not like trying to fake stuff. So
yeah.
Anyway, I've filmed this thing. I've seen it on the TV, on a video screen. I'm like, what is it? So I've gone back there, and what you've got to realize, it's only about 15 to 18 meters away from me. It's not that far away. But it's really deceptive, the footage, because the way it was set up, the actual camera. It wasn't set up, you know, in a way to make it look close or anything. And when you go to that rock ledge, it's 12 foot high in some places. And whereabouts it was probably 11 foot high. So it was about a foot underneath that. So it was like 10 foot high. And there's nothing there that, like, I think even a wallaby wouldn't even be able to leap and get up that high to get up there. It's just too much. So, and it's not anyone standing there because, look, on that day, it was a really drizzly, rainy day. There was only one person on the trail that was a local with their dog. When I went in, it was very quiet. And when people hike and they're in groups, they make noise. You can hear them half a K down the trail. So you know when people are around, and no one hikes quiet. Everyone hikes noisily. They all talk and have a good time. So there was no one there. And this thing's, there's a rock ledge 11, 12 foot high, and it's 15 meters away from me. And I got it for 6 frames. So you only realize... you can only like get a feel for what's the video is about if you actually go to the actual site and you see where I was standing to where it was, and then you kind of go, people go, shit, we don't know it was that close. And they look at the rock ledge, and look, I'd have to, I'm nearly 6 foot, I'd have to stand on my shoulders to be twice my height to be a level with the rock ledge nearly, or just have my head peeking over the top of it. So I don't know how many people are that tall. I know people are 7 foot tall, but that's still, you still got 3 foot of a body, you know, to reach the top of a 7 foot tall person. So it's just something that I just happened to catch in the background, and you're just very lucky because you don't go out. Like, people go out and they have YouTube channels and look, oh, I've got eye shine and I got this and I got that. That doesn't happen that way. I go out 10 times and I'm lucky to get one thing like a vocalization or a wood knock, and that's it. Mm. And that's, I'm lucky to get that. So, you know, and with the fires around, Blue Mountains has gone really quiet, so it's made it even harder. We're trying to find other areas now. So,
yeah, I mean, some of the things I found really interesting in the film, Dan, was obviously... It's not something I've heard a lot about when it comes to the Yowie. Was the guys seemed to stumble across what looked like some kind of nest and a structure. And as we're saying here, you know, we're talking about an area where, you know, you have to drive a couple of hours to get to where you need to get to, and then you're hiking for a bit more as well. You know, these are not the places where somebody's just going to go wandering about, mucking about. And once again, we always have this when it comes to things, when it comes to like Bigfoot and Sasquatch, Dan, that people say, oh, well, it's just hoaxes. And you think, well, if you're in the middle of nowhere and nobody knows where you are, and these are sort of far out trails and hiking where most people probably don't know where they are, most casual hikers at least, the chances of somebody going out there to hoax something on the off chance that a week, a month, 6 months later, somebody's out there looking for evidence and they stumble across it, I find nonsensical, really, Dan. And it was not something I'd heard in regards to the Yowie, in regards to structures and nesting areas. So is this something that seems to be coming out because more people are looking for it? Or is it something that's always been there and people have been kind of, well, we're not really sure what these things are?
Yeah. It's more people going out because there's a lot of Facebook groups out there, and a lot of people are getting into that and they're learning more that way of what people are showing them and telling them, this is what we've found. And so that's, some people are learning, you know, and there's just a lot of people out there which are showing people the wrong things too, which, you know, gives them the wrong idea of what they should be looking for and all that too. So there's a lot of people out there doing some dodgy stuff. But yeah, there's more people out there. Plus, see, when you get out to places and you walk, you know, 2 hours along a trail, and then you spend maybe half an hour bush bashing it through thick bush to get away from the trail and away from people, and then you start finding these, you know, structures. And there's like, you can tell something's been in there, and it's big enough for, like, you know, someone that's 6 foot tall, or maybe two or three people that big to lay down in there or sit up. You kind of think, well, you know, why is, like, a little fox or something wouldn't sit in something like that? It's too open. They have like little caves and things like that. Yeah. And kangaroos don't do it, and wombats make their own holes, and possums live in the tree. So what else is in there? There's no lions and tigers, and there's no bears. And so what could be in here? So the first thing we look for is maybe there's like hairs stuck on the trees as they're going in, might rub some hair off them. So look for hairs, and there's always spider webs around, so see if there's any spider webs of hairs hanging down. Or we try to, you know, sometimes you get a bit of a musty smell, which is known, you know, Yowies and Bigfoots so don't have like a real musty kind of smell. So we do look for them things, but like you said, no one's faking it. You can't go, you go to the, look, if anyone ever goes to the Blue Mountains or any mountainous region and hikes through up and down trails and goes for a couple of hours, like, why would I go a couple of hours into the bush, sit there all day just to hope someone might camp here so I can throw one rock at them and then I'm going home? Like, why? Like, you know, one thing I do say to people, these hiking trails that are that hard, it keeps the idiots away.
Yeah.
Idiots don't go in there. They just want to go and, you know, get in their car and burn around the streets and run amok and do stupid things and sit around and smoke and talk. And people that, a lot of people that hike are intelligent, really down-to-earth people that, you know, people lose clothes. They don't go, oh, that's a good jumper, I'll keep it. They hang it up on a tree near the trail to go, well, the people have gone out there, they're going to hike back. They'll go, oh, yeah, here's my jacket, I've dropped it. So you see that all the time. People hang up things in the trees to say, well, the person that comes along, they dropped it, will come back along and grab that jacket, you know. So they're thinking about others. I found, like, someone's hat down Glenbrook, and I end up had his phone number in it. I rang him up and said, mate, I found your hat. He goes, I was really upset, like, that hat's been all around the world with me, and I was really, you know, upset. I lost it. I said, oh, I'm going to go to Glenbrook. Whereabouts do you live in the Blue Mountains? He goes, I live in Glenbrook. So I stopped in and gave him his hat before I went hiking. So, you know, so he said, there's a lot of people, like, go out there to, you know, they don't want to do stupid things like that. You know, like, you don't hike 2 hours to go and try and do it tough and to pull one prank, like throw a rock or hit a tree once and then, I don't know, then you can hear them walk away in the bush, like, and back on the trail and go home. You don't hear that. It doesn't happen. So people that say it's faking, come out with me, bring all your gear with you, like your water and your food and your tent and your sleeping, like your stuff for cold weather, because you usually go out in cold weather. It's hot weather. It's just, you just don't go out in hot weather. It's just, it's too hard.
Yeah.
And all your other gear, come out with me and we'll take you 2 or 3 hours in the bush. And then when something happens, tell me who's done it. You know, and tell me, well, who does a wood knock 50 meters from you? There's no wind, so wood knocks can happen when trees are rubbing together. They make a knock noise. It does happen. But when there's no wind around and everything's still and you hear bang, something gets smashed up against a like a big bit of wood smashed up against a tree. Who's doing that? Like, nothing else has got a thumb that can hold it, and kangaroos don't do that. They're the only thing that you could possibly say that might have a chance. So, yeah, it just doesn't happen, mate.
Yeah. I mean, there were loads of other bits. I mean, there's a bit where Tony and Duo go back towards the end of the film, and Tony's not, you know, he's a bit nervous about staying where they have to stay, Dan. It's quite interesting because he's obviously a very well-educated man. He's very balanced. He knows it. You know, he deals with the perceptions that you can create something. And it's really interesting to see that he just doesn't feel very comfortable. And yet, nothing overly strange seems to happen. And it's only towards the end, when they're deciding that they're going to go, that they suddenly stumble across these saplings that have been snapped about 6 foot up. And one of the interesting aspects of that is that Tony finds another tree that's very similar, because I think they end up finding three that have been snapped at about 6 foot.
Yep.
And people go, oh, well, that's easy to do. And then Tony, bless him, tries his damnedest to snap one of these trees, and he just can't do it. And I think often people think, oh, well, it's not a real tree. That's how hard can it be to snap? But I think unless you've really tried it, or you know anything about working with wood or anything like that, Dan, you'll be amazed just how much effort it takes. And obviously, Tony can't snap it at all.
You try and stand next to not a huge tree, but it's like a tree that's probably a bit thicker than like a cricket ball or something like that, you know?
Mm.
You try to get there and then grab it, and it's 6 foot in the air, so you get your two hands and try and snap that tree at 6 foot high and do it three or four times. You can't even do it once. The wood's bloody hard to break, mate. Like, even if they've been rotted a little bit and maybe they had some sort of termites or something, you know, attack them, they're still bloody tough to break, mate. You know, I've tried it. Even the one I found that was broken at Glenbrook, and I tried to break it again, it just like bent like a fishing rod. I couldn't break it. So it takes some force to break them things, you know. So, and you're looking, you know, if people go, oh, look, it could have been a storm. Well, why is it only three trees that are about 5 to 10 meters apart on the same level, all broken, but everything else is not wrecked around it? So, but I do know trees suffer from dehydration and heat and all that kind of stuff. So from the cold and the hot. So if it's a hot day and all of a sudden it's minus, trees will dehydrate. And if a big wind comes, it can knock them over. They're at their, you know, they're weak. So I've looked into all that, but it doesn't happen on a massive scale. So, you know, these ones, when they're broken, you can see you can tell a tree that's kind of broken from being termite ridden, or it's had force. You can see this, you know, you can see it and you go, gee, something's really taken a lot of force to break this, you know. So, and a lot of these trees aren't really that big. So, they're covered by the other bigger trees from the winds hitting them and not the smaller ones, unless a big tree falls over and hits it and breaks it. Yeah. But you look around and see, well, there's no fresh tree that's fallen over. This one's still got kind of green leaves on it, so it's only been broken within the last couple of days. What broke it? You know, you've got to sit there and go, well, how come they've all broke the same way?
Yeah.
They're all leaning the same way, you know? You're like, okay, like, that's weird. So, you know, them things do make you question why, and then why break the trees all a certain way, not break one way and not the other? So, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, that was the other interesting aspect of that. They'd all been broken pointing the same way, and they were all kind of spaced out. And as we were saying about Tony trying to break one, there was a sapling that was absolutely fine next to one of the broken ones, which he was trying to demonstrate just how hard it was. And so therefore you would say, well, why would something that random occur unless it had been deliberately done? And these are the things I think often that we can sometimes overlook or whatever, like I say, because when Attila and the team find that nest, I wasn't aware that that had been going on in regards to Yowie's Dan. How common are they to be found out there in the bush?
No, it's pretty much only about the third one I've found.
Mm.
Yeah, it's not a common thing. And like, I've bush bashed it a lot in different places. And when we go bush bashing, it's like we wear helmets. I've got snake gaiters on because, you know, we've got like the second, third and fourth deadliest snake in the world going around the places where we're walking. So And, you know, we don't come across that often. It's pretty much, you know, if you come across one, it's like gold. And
yeah,
then you try to get as much information as you can. And then, you know, like the some places where it's more grassy areas, they've found where, you know, where sometimes you see, you might see a documentary. It's like somewhere from like Canada or America, and you see where a bear's been sleeping and all the grass is like pushed around in a circle. Like it's like a mini crop circle.
Yeah.
You know, that's what apes do. Like some of the big apes do that. And we found that at some times. I haven't personally found it, but some people have found them things more up in Queensland that I know of, and maybe northern New South Wales, but I haven't found down here myself. Some of the people might have, but yeah, they on occasions them kind of bedding has been found. And then some people say that they do sleep in the trees as well. Hmm. So there's sometimes when you see a lot of vines, you know, sometimes it does look like it's like a small bed up there where apes do make their beds up in the trees and they sleep for the night, and then they don't usually stay in that same bed. Like the next time they'll go and make another one because they've got to keep moving to find food. So yeah, they have been found on occasions, mate.
Hmm.
Yeah, it was very. I mean, like I said, the only criticism I've got of the film is it's not long enough, Dan, for me, because it's just under an hour, and I was wanting more and more content, really, because it's so well made. Attila's done a fabulous job. It's not one of those films that makes massive leaps of faith. You've got people like yourself out there in the field doing some research with Attila and Tony and Duo and others, two Garys, I think they are as well. And then obviously you've got people like Gary Opitt giving their opinions, and obviously Gary explains his hearing encounter that he had, which, you know, you would probably call as a class 2 in regards to that kind of aspect of it. So for me, I just found it a really well-made, balanced and informative documentary that I think serves everybody involved in it greatly. And I think it pushes the conversation in regards to what's going on with Yowies to a different level, Dan. And I think everybody involved in it should be very proud of their achievements and what they've done. So how's the feedback been? How's the response being for Attila and the rest of you?
Yeah, Attila's, there's been a lot of comments, both his media page and Facebook. His media company's Moonlark Media. So if you look up Moonlark Media or Paranormal Investigator Series, he has all these videos and stuff on there, like trailers. And there's a lot of great comments on there, even comments on some other websites that are talking about the documentary. So there's been a lot of people saying good things, and you do get your stupid idiotic comments that, you know, it just comes with the territory, and you have a bit of a laugh at it. We look at them and go, gee, look at this one, this is a funny one. In general, yeah, comments have been really, really good. But the funny thing is, when we were making it, and some people that I know that are researchers that are in it, they're saying, oh, what's in it? And I said, look, I don't really know, because Attila doesn't show me anything that he's filmed. He just goes ahead and does his thing, and then, you know, he says, yeah, I've finished about 20% of the, you know, documentary now. And then so he decided to show Duo and myself the first 15 minutes of the documentary before he'd even finished it. He says, I've done the first 15 minutes and this is what it is. So we watched it and went, that's excellent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's really good. We get to the premiere showing of the night, the first 15 minutes is different. He's changed it, and it's even better. So when people ask me, what's in it? I say, I don't know, man, because Attila changes stuff all the time. So, yeah, the first 15 minutes was different, and I just went, Attila, that was heaps better than the one I saw, and the one I saw was great. Yeah. Like, so he just sits there and watches and goes, no, I can make that better. Yeah, so it's been a lot of people that I know that are not into Yowies, and, like, I just come out and call myself Yowie Dan from AYR. You had the people, you can put your name down so people are making avatar names. I just went, I'm in Yowies, my name's Dan, Yowie Dan. That's how I got Yowie Dan, that's it. It's very simple. So when I was on Facebook and stuff, I just put Yowie Dan, and everyone knows I'm into Yowies, and they all rah, 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 and joke and laugh and that. But then next minute you get a phone call, oh, someone's been like having a lend of your own. They go, hey, I've got a friend or something, they seen a Yowie, can they talk to you on the phone? I said, I thought you thought they were bullshit. Next minute I'm talking to someone about Yowie. So, you know, everyone it doesn't bother me. I just have a laugh. And I said, Darren, I'll get you back with something later, you know, if you want to, you know, pay out on me or something. But it's all kind of died down and everyone just doesn't bother no more. They know I'm into it. Everyone, my family, my friends, everyone knows I'm into it. And I take people out if they want to go out, you know, take them to some spots and say, look, something happens. If it doesn't, it doesn't. And then I got a mate, Darren, and we haven't done it for a while because of COVID and just, you know, he's got young kids and everything. And so it's hard to meet up and we'll just go on a trail and we'll hike the trail, but we'll take head torches, but we won't use them. We'll just hike in the dark.
Yeah.
So that's how you get things. If you walk around in the nighttime and you got your torch blazing and, you know, and we'll just walk quiet, you know, and something happens, I'll get the parabolic and I'll, oh yeah, I've got something. So we've got some things that way. But, yeah, it's, Attila is buying new gear all the time to make things really like even more professional. You know, he's pretty much got most of the gear that he wants. And he showed me a lens the other day for his camera and he goes, oh, I've got this lens. And it was like $2,000 or something. And just holding the lens was like about 2 kilos.
Yeah.
Like, people don't realize when we go in to these locations, we'll hike up and down mountainsides, we'll travel a couple of hours. My backpack probably weighs 30 kilos with, you know, the clothes you got to take. Like, you just take one set of clothes to hike in and hike out.
Yeah.
And then you take a set of clothes in to sleep in because you can't sleep in smelly, stinky BO clothes. You just can't do it. So you close the hike in. And when we do this, it's always cold. So it's all thermals and gloves and beanies and, you know, jumpers and long pants and socks and everything like that. And then you got a little blanket or you got a sleeping bag. I got a onesie, look like an astronaut, but it's really good. and it all weighs up. So by the time you grab your bag and you go to places where there's no water. So if you got a, I really ration it where I say 1 liter of water to go in, 1 liter of water while I'm there to cook with, maybe half a liter to drink. And then while I'm there, while I'm resting, and then a liter to drink while I'm going out. Plus I'll have like maybe a couple of 2 liter Coke bottles in the car of water to drink, you know, to in case someone needs something. But Attila, we have a joke. He turns up, he's got the 24 pack of Coke, water bottles.
Yeah.
So he turns up, we go, you know, you got your 24 pack. He doesn't carry them all, but he goes, yeah, you want some water? I'm usually, yeah, I'll grab one, you know, but you got to realize he's got his bag. He's got a 110 liter bag. So he's got the biggest bag he can get. He's got like, his tent in there, he's got his clothes, and then he's got all his gear. And he's got multiple cameras, he's got batteries, multiple batteries for cameras. So he might have a camera, he might have 4 batteries for that camera. He might have another camera, another 4 batteries. He'll have a gimbal, he'll have a tripod in there, he'll have this and that, he'll have all these other gear, he'll have his lenses, and plus, you know, food and water. And I picked up his bag one day and I went, that was well over 50 kilos. You know, Attila's not a small bloke. He's about 6'3" and maybe a bit taller. And I'm glad you're carrying that thing, Attila, because that'd kill me. And so it's only like when we made track, it was like Attila filmed it and it was me and Duo there. There was no camera crew behind him and there was no catering mob there waiting for us to come back. And there was nothing like that. It was just us three. And the less people you got, the more results you're more likely to get. You go out there with 5, 6, 7, 8 people, nah, you get nothing. You make too much noise. Whatever's there is just gone. You walk in with a couple of his and you get results. That's what I've found over the years. So
brilliant. I mean, one of the other things as well is that there are 3 witness accounts in the film, Dan, as well. 2 of whom didn't want to appear because, you know, regardless, I think often we get, I mean, there was a big story that broke at the beginning of December about 3 guys in northern Queensland who were terrified when they'd come across one. And I know a couple of years ago we had the truck driver who had an encounter on the road. And occasionally these people are very open about what's happened to them and aren't bothered about it. But there's 2 encounters. I mean, one of them is from a paranormal researcher who didn't want to appear, which I find quite peculiar that someone's quite happy to talk about ghost hunting, but they're not interested. They don't want to sort of come forward and put themselves as a Yowie witness, Dan. But the gentleman who's telling his story, it's one of those classic stories where somebody's gone out camping and something just turns up and starts bothering them. And he just seemed absolutely terrified by what he'd encountered. Are people still reticent about coming forward and saying, yeah, I've seen something? Or do you think as more people are beginning to look at this subject in a serious manner, Dan, that more people are quite happy to come forward and say, yeah, I've seen something and this is what's happened to me?
Yeah, well, with the case of people not coming out, sometimes it's their jobs that they got. The odd occasion, you know, I've heard it's been like someone's a judge and they've seen one, but they don't want to bring it out and give their name or anything like that because, you know, people might say, you're a judge, but you're saying you've seen Yowie. So how can you judge people in a criminal, you know, court? So it could be they got a really high, like a job that's a CEO of a company, or they're a doctor, or they're like a lawyer, or they're a policeman, or they're a ranger. There's been many stories I've heard that people have had certain jobs where they just they'll tell the story, but they'll refuse to say their name or have it associated with them, but they're happy just to tell the story as long as they're anonymous. But then there's other people, like you're saying with the paranormal. Yeah, it's a bit weird, you're talking about ghosts and poltergeists and that, but then, you know, you won't talk about a living creature that might be running around in the bush. I don't know, I don't get that one. That's pretty weird, you know. Like, we've been out filming for the documentary track, and I can tell you a few stories here that probably haven't come out that we can talk about them now, because track's come out and we're under the – we couldn't talk about anything while track was getting made, you know?
Yeah.
Like anyone, if you're making things. But, look, we've seen some really weird stuff that's happened while we've been out filming. And, like, the first one, we were in the Blue Mountains – and there was only four of us. It was a fellow researcher, Simon Young. He delves into the dog man and in America, and he's right into that kind of stuff. But I didn't have a thermal then. He had a thermal, but it was an old style one where if you wanted to film with it, you had to link it through Wi-Fi to your mobile phone or an iPad and film through the iPad or the phone. You couldn't press the button actually on the thermal itself, where the one I've got, I can take photos while I'm videoing and everything like that. It's got 16 gig memory in it. Plus, I can Wi-Fi and record stuff onto my phone and a tablet. So we've gone out in the bush and we've been out for a while. We heard one wood knock and nothing happened. So we've pretty much climbed out. Took us a while to get out. It's pretty hard. And we're standing around in the car park and, you know, talking. And then Duo says, oh, I just seen something run across the road, the dirt road. And we're like, did you see it? I'm like, no. So we've gone over with the torch and we've shined down in the bush and can't see anything. I thought it might be a little wallaby. And he says, no, it was on two legs. It was running like a little kid, but it was really black. I'm like, and that was when I first kind of started to know Duo. I didn't know him before track. And I didn't, when you first see someone, you're not sure how they pick up things and how they kind of interpret it. So I kind of went, it might have just been a wallaby, mate. It might have been nothing. So
yeah,
pretty much within a couple of minutes while we're talking, and he says, it's up near the rocks. There it is. And I'm looking up and I'm like, I didn't see anything. He goes, no, it's like a little man standing there, a little skinny. I'm like, what? He goes, it's like Slender Man. I'm going, yeah, I know what Slender Man is, but I didn't think that was real. And he goes, no, I'm just saying it's like that. Don't say it was it. Next minute, Tiller goes, yeah, I can see it. There it is. And I'm like, and it would be there for a split second and then it would disappear. I said, I didn't see anything. Anyway, next minute Simon goes, you know, like, yeah, I seen it. And I'm like, well, I didn't see anything. And then bang, it appeared between these two big massive rocks and it was standing there. And it's probably 5 or 6, well, maybe 8 meters away from us. And I'm like, yeah, there it is. And it just looked like this little black guy standing there, like pitch black. Like, no face, you couldn't recognize, just it was a figure. So Simon's got the thermal and he goes, yeah, I can pick it up on the thermal, but it's not showing as heat. It's just showing, I can just see it. So then Attila gets the thermal and Simon's going, I'm going to get my phone to try and film it. And then Attila goes, I said, let me look on the thermal. And just as he went to give it to me, it disappeared. So that was the first weird thing that we saw out there. And unfortunately for Simon, he left his big torch down in the valley. So I said, look, I'm going to go back there. I just want to check the place out one more time in the light. So I went down there, found his torch. And as I was walking out, it was raining and drizzly. It was all wet. There's no trails in there. You've got to bush bash it. And then I heard like a big metal spoon hitting like a billy can, like bang, coming from down at like maybe a couple hundred meters from where I just walked up. And there's no one down there.
Yeah.
And so it was really weird that was one thing that happened to us. Like, we've been to film in the Belangolo State Forest, and you might know that's the backpackers killing zone where he'd bury people.
Yes.
Down there,
some English
backpackers. So we actually found one of the grave sites, the areas, because there was a big German flag and it said "Rip Simone" for Simone Schmidl.
Yeah.
And we happened just to come across the big flag, and we were filming in an area near there. Nothing much happened, but it's actually, if you look up on YouTube Moonlight Media and you go to the videos and look up the forest that night, and the forest that night is some weird stuff that's been happening while we've been out. And that was the one episode is the Belangolo State Forest, and when Attila was walking there, I've actually got thermal footage, and he said he got grabbed on the ankle, something grabbed him, like a hand come around his ankle, and he fell over, and he had like a couple of $1,000 worth of camera in his hands, and you're not going to fall over and drop your camera just to say, oh, I got grabbed on the ankle, when you didn't, when you drop your $2,000-$3,000 camera, you don't do that. So yeah, he was freaked out, and that place is really spooky, mate. It's like there was no moon there, so it was black. Like I couldn't see my hand in front of my face. It was like I was in a cave.
Yeah.
And the boys had actually went back down there again, him and Duo, and I got the thermal. I'm standing on the dirt road near where we parked the car, and they're walking back down this little trail, and I said, look, I've got the thermal on you, I can't see anything. And then just over my shoulder, it's like, this is what happened. It was like someone breathed over my shoulder. It was like, and I'm like, someone just breathed over my shoulder, and I'm just standing in the dark by myself. I had to look around, and I'm thinking, is there a malad around me? And I'm like, oh my god, like this place is like freaky. So there's some really weird things that have happened. Yeah, like we've gone out to another place in the Blue Mountains, and it's probably about a 10K car drive to the end, but we weren't at the end. We stopped at an area where we think we can get some results. So we've been going to this area a few times. We've actually got some trail cameras out there, and they've been out there for about 3 months now. We're probably going to leave them out there for 6 months and just see if we maybe capture something. I've never captured anything with a trail camera, but you're not going to get nothing if you haven't got anything out there. So
yeah.
Anyway, we're finished doing what we had to do, and we just thought, we'll go. And the boy said, we'll just make a coffee. And I said, I don't feel like one. So they're just sitting next to, I had my car parked along the road, and Attila's was off like in a little parking area. So the boys are sitting down and they're having a coffee, and pitch black. And I'm on the dirt road, and I said, Attila, is that a car coming? Like, because where we were, you kind of have to like zigzag up the road, up a bit of the ridge, and then you go over the other side of the ridge, and then you're down. Anyway, I'm going, the area's all lit up, like daytime. Like, gee, that must be bright lights. And it was probably an area that was about 100 meters away, and the road turned to the right, and it went up to the hill, turned to the left, and it went over the ridge, and it was gone. And Attila's going, there's no car coming, man. So I went, that was really weird. It looked like daytime, not headlights. So I'm just standing there with my arms crossed, and I thought, should I get my camera out and just put the night vision on and put it on the bonnet and just videotape that area? And I was going to do it, and I just went, don't worry about it. Anyway, I think I should have done it, because I'm standing there for 20 minutes just looking up this road, just, and Taylor's like, what are you doing? I'm like, man, there was something there. I'm telling you, there was something there. So I'm just standing there. 20 minutes later, you know, when you see the beach, like a beach ball size, a good size beach ball, ball lightning just comes out of the trees about a meter off the ground, and it travels about 3 meters along from in the bush into the middle of the road. And just as it's getting out of the bush into the middle of the road, I'm like, what the F's that? And then Attila just does this almighty one big leap, because he's a big boy, and just leaps behind me, and he sees it as well. And he's like, what the? And next minute it blew up. And the whole place just looked like it was daytime, like the sun was shining on that area in a split second, and it was gone. And I got to see it for a good 3 to 4 seconds, and it was ball lightning. It was like flames inside this ball, and it was like a red ring around it. But the light didn't – like the place was lit up, but it wasn't like there was like beams of light coming out of it. The light kind of stayed within the ball, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But the area was lit up at the same time, like the sun had just appeared and said, I'm just shining that little 50-meter area to daytime, and everywhere else is going to be nighttime. And it was like – and then Duo's trying to get up, because Duo's not as tall as Attila and myself, and he tried to get up and see, but he missed it. And Attila, I'm going, did you see that, Attila? And he's going, I saw it. I'm going, And I was ball lining. He goes, yeah, mate. And I'm gone. So he's got the camera and we're running up to the end there. We're running up and he's got it on film somewhere and he's going, what do you think it was? I'm going, I don't know, man, but I told you there was something here. That's why I stood there watching for 20 minutes. And to this day, I'm going, all right, from now on, if I think something's there, I'm going to put the camera and I'm going to hit record because if nothing happens, I can just delete it.
Yeah.
Easy,
you know?
And I was been kicking myself. I would have had it on video. I was spewing, mate, because I got some good night vision on my camera and I could zoom. I could zoom it right into that area. I would have got it right on. Anyway, the other thing that happened was we're in the Jameson Valley, not far from where where the trees were broken, and that when they did that nighttime expedition. I was supposed to be there that night. I couldn't make it because one of my boys had an AFL grand final and I was there watching it and I couldn't get in. I was going to hike in at night, but it was just too dangerous.
Yeah.
So I decided to go the next day. So I've come in the next day. This is actually the next day after they filmed that night. So I've gone there and the boys have said, hey, well, like, you know, some weird stuff happened though. Like, we heard some lady screaming out and stuff like that. And there's people camp along that trail, but there was no one along that trail because we walked there during the day and checked all the campsites up to near Mount Solitary. And there's no one there. People are right up in the mountain. They go up there, but not to the area that we were. So it was really quiet. And to get to where we have to go, it takes about 40 minutes to hike down from the top of the ridge. And then it's about a good hour to maybe an hour and a quarter to get to where we were. So it's not really close. So if anyone's playing a gag, it's, you know, it's not happening. So we're sitting there and they're telling me stories of what happened. And this is after we walked into the valley, a different valley, to try and film to see if there's anything there. But there was nothing happened. It was pretty quiet. So we decided to go back and I hadn't even set my tent up. We pretty much got there. We left our bags in the bush and we walked into the valley, you know, probably a kilometer or so, and to get away from everyone in case something happened, we knew it wasn't human related. So we've finally got back, got our bags, and I'm going to set my tent up. So I'm just sitting down because it was tough going to get into the valley and get out. And they're telling me all this stuff that happened to them the night before. So we're sitting down and I'm on the chair facing the trail. And the trail's going north-south, so I'm looking westwards, and they're sitting in their two little camp chairs looking towards me, and we're getting a few sticks to maybe start a little fire up, and I was just going to set my tent up, and then this is about 2 o'clock in the morning. So it's not, you know, it's getting pretty early in the morning. And next minute, this big kind of white thing just went flying through the bush. It had like a body shape to it. It wasn't an orb. But it lit up the whole area, and I'm nearly, you know, when you nearly fall back on your chair and fall over, and I'm just going, what the hell is that? And the boys, they could see, like, the light emanating from behind them, and they're going, oh, they looked around, and it was gone by the time they saw it. And they said, oh, they just kind of looked at each other, and I said, oh, you know, I'm going to set my tent up now, you know, kind of thing, and maybe something else might happen. And they're like, because I'm like, oh, and they're going, no, we want to go, man. And I'm like, come on, man, I've hiked all this way in. I've got hiked my tent in. I want to at least set it up and use it, you know. And they're like, oh, we're going to go, man. This place is freaking us out. I'm like, all right, you guys go. I've got my carry. I'll stay here. Oh, man, I've camped in the bush heaps myself. Doesn't bother me. I would have just stayed up all night and put the camera and let it roll and set me parabolic up and see what I could get. The Tiller's like, you sure you want to stay? And I can see him and Joe. I really wanted to go. And I'm like, all right, let's go. So I put me back. I'm lucky I didn't unpack anything. So I've got everything still packed.
Yeah.
Other than some of the gear that I use, like I didn't have the thermal in. I just only bought the thermal after that. I had like a night vision camera and I had my parabolic dish. And so I packed them back up in the bag and off we went. So we're hiking along the trail and we're making our way out. And see, this trail was, they used it to get the kerosene shale out of the area. They were mining it.
Yeah.
So a lot of people, this is like 1870s. So there's a lot of people that went down there. There's probably people that died down there from diseases or mining accidents or just fell off a cliff or anything like that. So
yeah,
there's probably spirits down there, I could guess so. So there's a lot of people been down there before us. So anyway, so that's why there's a trail there. And you can find bits of the railroad and like spikes to hold the railroad in where the little donkeys would pull the carts of the shale all the way around to the where the scenic railway is. That's why it was made, to put the shale in and take it back up to the top. That's why the scenic railway's there, and it's the steepest railroad in the world. So it's pretty freaky to go on. I've been on it recently again. So we're walking out on this trail, and look, I'm about 10 or 15 metres in front of the boys because Duo's saying, I think someone called me name out. And I'm like, we're like, what? And he's like, yeah, someone like called me name. It's really dark. It's quiet. You don't hear anything. You hear the odd owl in the distance making its noise. And I'm walking along, and everywhere here, because it's so wet a lot of the times because the sun can't penetrate the canopy of the trees, a lot of wood rots. So there's a lot of fallen trees, and there's a lot of just messed up areas where you can't hike through. So we're going on this trail, and the ridge up just above me, 20 metres in front of the boys, it's probably 3 o'clock in the morning now, because we've hiked a fair way to get to this point before we start our climb up. And anyway, you go along, and then I hear this voice go, watch out! And I'm like, what the hell? And I'm going, did one of you guys tell me to watch out? And they're going, and Attila and I, they're like, doing something? And they're like, what? Like, no. And they're like, what did you mean? I'm going, someone just yelled to me, watch out, in a big, deep male voice. And I'm like, geez, I've been hiking through here at nighttime a lot of times, and I never had anyone tell me to watch out for no reason. So, yeah, there's some of the things that have happened to us while we've been out making the documentary. So the Tillers put them in that forest that night.
Yeah.
They're only about 7 or 8 minutes long. But if you look at the picture of the forest that night, it looks like a face. That is actually a face that's on a tree.
Mm.
It's not carved. It's in the middle of the Blue Mountains. We found it, and Attila, all he did was change it to that light blue color. Yeah. It's a face on a tree. It's like it's alive, mate. It's really weird. We found it in the middle of the valley. Like, no one carved it, mate. It's not carved. It's natural. It's just the way all the bark sits. It looks like eyeballs and, like, mouth and nose. And Attila goes, I've got to make that for the picture for the forest at night. So, yeah. So that's some of the things that happen while we're out there. There's some weird stuff that happens out in the bush, and some things that we just can't explain, right?
Yeah, sounds very creepy. And I would imagine as well, it's quite surprising, Dan, because, you know, with the greatest intentions, you've gone out there on the search for yowies. I don't expect any of you were expecting to come across weird lights, strange voices, and people breathing down your necks.
Because, and it really does kind of, like, freak you out a bit, because you're not expecting it.
Mm.
It just happens like that. Bang, it happens. And then you're like, what was that? And not like it does it again and says, oh, I said watch out. Didn't you get me the first time? You're like, no. You know, you're in the middle of the bush and you're like, there's no one up this ridge. This is like got heaps of fallen trees and there's vines and stuff. Well, who's waiting up on a trail at 3 o'clock in the morning to say watch out? Like, nah, this is weird, man. Like, yeah, but if nothing happens yowie related and this stuff happens, it does make the night worthwhile. Like, something happened, you know, like something did happen. It made it worthwhile. And, you know, when I go to places, I'm like, oh, in the daytime, oh, this is where something told me to watch out. And this is where I saw this. And this is where this happened. If it's like, look, if it's yowie related and things start, like trees start and get shake, tree snaps and wood knocks and, you know, I'm seeing eyes shine and howls, and I might see one. Well, I'm ready for it. That's what we're there for. But all this other stuff, no, you're not there ready for it. And then you start questioning yourself, like, geez, what's out there, you know?
Unexpected bonus, if you could describe it now.
Yeah. And look, we don't take any weapons. Well, not like in America where they go out looking for the yowies and, oh, I'm sorry, Bigfoots, and the Americans have got that many weapons. And when we tell them that, look, we might go out, we might take like a stick with us or like an air horn or something. They're like, what the hell? I go, well, we haven't got mountain lions. We haven't got bears. Like, you know, they go, but a yowie could get you. Like, all right, fair enough. If it does, we just try to run away. I don't know. Like,
So what's next then? Is Attila planning on doing a sequel to Track? Because I think it certainly deserves it, Dan. And if so, what's the plan with that?
Yeah, it's called Tracking the Law. So in Tracking the Law is a bit different to Track. It's not just all about researchers and trying to find the yowie. Some part of it is, but Attila's got more of the indigenous aspect of it, and they're telling their story. yeah, so he's gone along those lines to show that the Indigenous Australians and their story and their culture and what they think of it and, you know, all that, all those different kind of things. And, yeah, so he's got a couple of the elders to talk that pretty much have never talked before to anyone about it. Gone to a few, probably a sacred area or two where there's kind of cave paintings where no white man has ever seen before. Where I wasn't there. It was only Attila and the elders. Like, they're pretty secretive when it comes to these areas where, yeah, you know, it's for the Indigenous folk and, you know, it's not for, you know, the white man to go and intrude. This is like their church to them, to us, you know. This is, yeah, this is their sacred, you know. So he's taken that aspect to it. So that's about all I know at the moment. I don't really ask any questions. I basically only know bits and pieces that he tells me and what we do. But unfortunately, we haven't really been able to do too much because of the COVID. Like, you know, we're talking before we started this podcast where, you know, how many lockdowns where we couldn't even go out of our suburbs to go to anywhere. And that was for 6 months. And then when, you know, we could go out of our suburb, we couldn't go to certain areas where out of the metropolitan area because all the country areas were locked, closed off to people,
yeah,
you know, to try and stop the spread going out to them areas. So, you know, it took a while before that to open. And when it did, well, we were straight out again.
Yeah.
So, but unfortunately, like I said, the fires have really ravaged a lot of areas which were reaping some really good results for us. You know, we were really getting some good results and some good finding some like signs that there was, you know, Yowies are out there and they're around. So these areas have just been totally destroyed and they're just pretty much the foliage and that was just burnt to the ground, you know. So they reckon like a million animals got killed in those fires, from koalas to possums to kangaroos. I was just finding like dead carcasses, charcoaled, all laying on, like in their thousands. So, unfortunately, that's the case. Where, but in Queensland, they've been having a lot of results. So, there's going to be some footage happening up in Queensland where the boys have been getting some results up there. We're hoping now that it's been a couple of years since the fires, the Australian bush does come back pretty well. The natives sometimes need fires to open up the seed pods to regrowth and that, but
yeah,
not on this extent. Not on this extent. This was just hell. Like our smoke from Australia went around the world,
yeah,
and people down the south coast around Batemans Bay, which is about 2.5 hours, maybe 3 hours away, they were like going into the ocean, into the lakes to get away from the fire because the fire was coming up to the shoreline where. And it was that hot. They just had to get everything and jump in boats and go and sit in the lake for a couple of hours while the fire burned itself out. So unfortunately, that's hindered a lot of the filming because that's where our areas were. Our research areas are just gone. There's nothing there.
Yeah. I remember seeing some of the footage of people evacuating and getting into the sea and to lakes and things down. And it was terrifying to witness. And it's one of those things that obviously, Australia's had a lot of wildfires and certainly certain parts of the US seem to have had some really bad ones. And I think often when you talk about a bushfire or something like that, people don't understand just how ferocious they are. And to see people basically running into water for their own protection and the sky was red, it was like the end of the world. It looked horrific, Dan. So how anything survives something like that is just remarkable. And for the bush to bounce back as quickly as it does, which is often the most amazing thing about nature, is it surprises us how quickly it does rebound in situations like that.
Yeah, especially the natives or the non-natives that happen to, you know, a bird might eat a seed and drop a seed in its droppings there and they grow, they'll die away, they're dead, but the natives will come back. But the fires, they make their own storms, they make their own winds, and they howl, and these fires were like 20 meters in the air, 30 meters in the air, maybe sometimes 50 meters in the air because the eucalypt trees are full of oil.
Yeah.
When they go up like a massive firecracker, and when there's like 50 of them together going up, mate, you just, the heat's 1,000 degrees or more. There was cars there where the actual aluminium parts of like the heads of the motor and the rims, they all melted and they were melting away. They melted the metal.
Wow.
So I know aluminium hasn't got a very high melting point, but a bushfire shouldn't get as hot to melt metal, but it did.
Dear me.
Goodness. So what's next for you then, Dan? Where can everybody keep up to date with you, or if they want to talk about any areas or any experiences, how can anybody get hold of you, my friend?
Well, I've just got my YouTube channel, Australian Yowie. It's just, I've got a couple of latest videos up there taken a month or two ago. Attila and myself went into an area, and that one looks really, it's really weird because up the top of the ridge, it's really dry, and you go down the bottom, it looks like you're in Jurassic Park and some little dinosaur is going to run past you. So that's a lot of big, like tall tree palms down there. So that's a good one to watch. I was doing a WordPress. It's still up. It's on WordPress. It's just yowiedan.com, and it's just some of the things I've come across and some of the different signs I've found and different things like footprints and finger marks in some weird places where no one should be, under ridges in the middle of nowhere and things like that. But my profile on Facebook is still up there, but I don't really get on Facebook that much. I usually just use the Facebook to talk to people through the Facebook Messenger.
Mm-hmm.
So if anyone wants to contact me through, they can just look up Yowie Dan on Facebook Messenger and say hello, and I'm happy to have a chat anytime. I'm available, you know. And a lot of people have done that and said, oh, you know, I'm really interested in Yowies. And, you know, I met a guy named John, and he's living over here with his Mrs. Michelle, and they live around the Hawkesby area. But he asked Adam Davis, do you know anyone in Australia that does Yowie research? And he said, yeah, go and see Yowie Dana, you know. And so he put him onto me, and we've been mates ever since, and we've gone out a few times. And I dragged him along a hike called the K to K. You go out just past the Jenolan Caves, and it's about a 50K hike back to Katoomba. And I've done it once, and I won't do it again. That's how hard it was. It was like doing the Kokoda Trail. It's all hard, and you come out with blisters, and you lose weight, and you're in pain for 2 weeks after you hike it. So we tried to do some research, but couldn't do any research. But one good thing come of it, I did leave a sound recorder out, and you can hear something walking up to this sound recorder and walk around it and then walk away. But when we did get to this area, and it's on the Cox's River, COX, Cox's River, that's how it's spelled. Anyway, this is probably about 11 o'clock at night. As soon as we got to places where we had the camp, we set up our tents, we ate our food and went straight to bed. We were that tired. But we had wood knocks happen as soon as we got there. As soon as we walked down, got down to the bottom, there's wood knocks everywhere. And it did look a similar area like the Patterson-Gimlin area in that Bluff Creek. It reminded me of Bluff Creek, and I'm going, are we going to see something walk around and I can videotape it? So it was really spooky area, that one. But, John and myself have been friends ever since. So if anyone wants to contact me, they can contact me. Just look up Yowie Dan on Messenger and message me. I'm happy to message on there and have a chat, or email AustralianYowie@gmail.com, and I'm happy to email talk that way.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put links to your YouTube channel and your email on there, Dan, if anybody wants to drop you a line. And thank you. It's been too long since we've had a real good chat. Thank you for updating me. Like I say, I absolutely love Track, and I recommend anybody who hasn't seen it should watch it either on Tubi or YouTube or Prime in North America as well. And really, it's a fantastic piece of work. So congratulations to everybody involved. And Attila is certainly a very talented filmmaker. So I look forward to tracking the lore. It sounds fantastic to get the indigenous opinion and history on that as well, because there are some marvellous reports and encounters that I think a lot of us aren't aware of just yet. So anything like that should be fantastic. So, Dan, thank you again for your time today, mate. It's been too long, and I can guarantee you it won't be another 2.5 years till we talk, mate.
I hope so. Yeah. No, it's been great talking to you again, and it's been too long, and we both got over the COVID, and I don't want to get it again. So, yeah, it's been great talking, mate, and hopefully, I'll let you know, if something comes up there in my research, days and nights, and as soon as something pops up, I'll let you know, and we can have a chat about it.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again, Dan. You take care, my man.
I will do. You too, Paul, and I'll speak to you soon.